Discussions in Depth Psychology is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute. Your host is Bonnie Bright.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Discussions in Depth Psychology, which is powered by Pacifica. I'm your host, Bonnie Bright, and I'm really happy to be able to bring you discussions with some of the individuals who are contributing to the field of depth psychology in really profound and important ways. And today, my guest is Polly Young Eisendrath, who is a Jungian analyst, psychologist, and author, and she's going to be presenting at the upcoming Trauma and Transcendence Conference at Pacifica, which takes place in June of 2018. So, Polly, thanks so much for spending some time with me today.
Oh, thanks, Bonnie.
Well, I'm really happy to have you with me. We're going to be talking about a new book you have coming out later this year in 2018, and that book is called Love Between Equals, Relationship as a Spiritual Path. And so we'll be talking about love and relationship today in addition to things like trauma and transcendence. But first, just let me read your bio so that everybody has more background on you, and then we'll jump in. Polly Young Eisendrath, PhD, is a Jungian psychoanalyst, psychologist, author, and speaker. She's clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Vermont, founding faculty at the Vermont Institute of the Psychotherapies, and past president of the Vermont Association for Psychoanalytic Studies. She is in independent practice with individuals and couples in central Vermont. She's also the chairperson of the nonprofit Enlightening Conversations, Buddhism and Psychoanalysis Meeting in Person. That organization hosts conferences in cities around the USA. Polly's also the author of 15 books, as well as many chapters and articles, and her books have been translated into more than 20 languages. Her most recent books include The Present Heart, a memoir of love, loss, and discovery, The Self-Esteem Trap, Raising Confident and Compassionate Kids in an Age of Self-Importance, and The Cambridge Companion to Jung, New and Revised, of which she is co-editor with Terrence Dawson. And of course, I mentioned already her forthcoming book, Love Between Equals, Relationship as a Spiritual Path, and that will be published in the fall of 2018 by Shambhala. So, Polly, you have obviously a long history and you've contributed so profoundly to a variety of different topics that all fall under the umbrella of depth and Jungian psychologies. But I think the best way to jump in is talking about love and relationships. Maybe you can start by sharing a little bit about love in the 21st century. Do you think that there are challenges that are different that are facing us in today's day and age than those in past eras?
Oh, absolutely, especially for what I call personal love, which is the love that we take very personally. It's the love that basically we have asked to be changed in a sense from what it has been traditionally. I like to say that we had three wishes for our personal love relationships, that they be between equals, that they be reciprocal and mutual, that we be able to choose anybody we want to love. We're not bound to traditions or to our tribes or whatever. And finally, that we have a witness who gets to know us as an individual, someone who can see us and understand us and hear us. And those were the wishes that we had for love. And we got all three of them, and they've made our personal relationships more difficult. It's like we got our wishes, and now it is very difficult for people to navigate their homes, their families, their marriages, their committed relationships, because everything has to be negotiated. There are a lot of power struggles, and there's a lot of personal feeling. If you think the person who's witnessing you just totally doesn't get you, that person that you've chosen so carefully and maybe chosen after having chosen others, you've chosen this one after having, let's say, a couple of failed earlier ones, that this is a tremendously painful situation if that partner does not get you, does not see you, does not seem to know you, and you have to negotiate on an equal basis a lot of issues, a lot of power, money, children, and so on based issues. So you put this whole combination of the wishes that we've had together with the issue of trying to have a committed relationship over time in order to have and develop a family, or in order simply to have and develop a friendship, a companionship. And it's very, very challenging. I actually think that Jung forecasted this in an essay that he published in 1925, which is called Marriage as a Psychological Relationship. And in there he says, the moment that we stopped choosing people from our own tribe, you know, where the parents and the grandparents were arranging the marriages, and we actually decided to choose somebody ourselves, to just look outside of the tribe and go after somebody who seemed to appeal to us for unknown reasons, at that moment, we fell into a situation that was going to require psychological development of the individuals who are in that relationship, or it was going to end with a lot of disillusionment and unhappiness, where I think we really were in the 20th century in a kind of cold war of the sexes, you know, a sort of war in marriage. Unless we learn to develop as individuals, to begin to see ourselves and our own desires to project and our own disavowed aggressions and so on, then we're really poised to be pretty unhappy. And as love has gotten more personal in the 21st century, where we really want a witness and we believe that we deserve one, I think those personal issues have intensified. So now, you know, if your relationship actually doesn't seem to suit you, and if you feel that your partner doesn't get you, doesn't see you, that may cause you some not just psychological problems, but health problems, so that you come to a point where you feel you cannot stay in the relationship and be true to yourself. In the past, when people got married for impersonal reasons. They took vows like, you know, in sickness and in health until death do us part, not because they thought they were going to be the greatest friends or they were going to be witnesses to each other, but because they were going to stick it out so that the family could develop and so that the family could go forward with whatever the wealth was or the farmland or the business that would move from generation to generation. So marriage essentially used to be like a corporation. You got into it through a contract and you stayed in it because you didn't want to be fired. And now it's much more like, I was going to say something like Facebook, but that seems a little extreme, but where you remain in it out of personal desire. You know, it's sort of like, this suits me. I'm getting something from this, or I'm not getting something from this, or I'm insulted by this. And so it's changed from being sort of a vow of impersonal loyalty to a vow of personal loyalty, and requires now, I think, very much a whole different set of skills than have ever been required, particularly for a marriage relationship to exist over time. And so the book is a lot about those skills, but where I think there's an interesting connection to the issue of trauma and relational trauma all across life, you know, not simply in families, but also relational trauma in society and so on, is that in an equal relationship, with somebody that you have chosen, who you want to be your witness, it is very likely that you are going to find an enemy as soon as the idealization ends and you begin to deal with the limitations and the power struggles and so on. There is a process then of projecting into your partner all of the hurts and all of the rejections, the humiliations, the disavowed parts of yourself, the needs and cares and so on that you haven't been able to fulfill, and to project that in such a way that you feel this person knows me so personally and has personally humiliated me, has personally insulted me in just this precise way that he or she knows is very offensive. So that tendency of creating an intimate enemy, you know, in the Jungian terminology, it would be the projection of the shadow, but I even think that's too mild for what I see going on. I see couples who have actually a kind of chronic problem with what, as a couples therapist, I would call projective identification, where both people are projecting the negative image into the other person, and then both people are identifying to some extent with that image. And so when they look in the mirror of the partner's eyes, what they see is a negative image of themselves. And they don't like it. They're defensive about it. And it gets into a kind of a vicious cycle Like today, I was talking to somebody, and this was in individual therapy, but it could have been in a couple's therapy. But she was saying how her husband never really listens in detail to what she says. And she was kind of detailing how this works. And then later I was asking her about the kinds of things that he was saying. And she said, you know, I really don't listen after a certain point. I listen to maybe the first paragraph or so, but after that I just kind of zone out. So I said, well, perhaps he would say that you don't listen to him also, that you maybe don't know him in detail. She said, oh, I'm sure he would say that. So if the two people were sitting in the room, the one person would say, I'm insulted because you rarely listen to me in detail. And the other one would say, hey, wait a minute, I'm insulted too. You rarely listen to me in detail. And that kind of what I call, you know, dark mirror is the sign of this projective identification. And it can go on and on in a painful way as each individual really meets up with the most difficult, destructive, and traumatic relational themes that have already happened to him or her that seem to be happening again. And that mm-hmm. creates, let's say, also the greatest possibility for transformation. As Jung says, it's really the opening to the individuation process for both individuals. But to go through that door of chronic projective identification into a renewal of intimacy and love, what I call true love, requires a number of skills and also a recognition that you haven't set this up simply because you've chosen the wrong person, and that it isn't there specifically because you had a difficult family or your childhood was difficult, but rather this is the condition of the kind of love that we want. And it's unconsciously taking us into a whole new horizon of relating, I believe, if it works, or it's just going to be a massive amount of narcissism and failure in love. But I do think that this form of 21st century love between equals has the possibility of transforming our understanding of self and other. So, you know, this is what I'm excited about. It's what I'm writing about. It's what I'm doing a lot of. I have something called the Institute for Dialogue Therapy, which I teach and supervise in, and it's about doing couple relationship in the framework of love between equals and projective identification as the trauma, and also the aspect of witnessing as the door through which we can move towards being able to relate closely to someone without making them into the enemy. So I'm hopeful about love in the 21st century, but I'm also concerned. I think we're facing a very big challenge. I assume that my experience here on the East Coast is similar to other people's experience on the West Coast, that pretty much everybody I meet in therapy and pretty much everybody I know in my social life is struggling in their intimate relationships.
Yes, there's just so much in everything that you just said, and we waded quite quickly into some of the dynamics of relationships, but I really heard what you were saying about the idea that those three things that used to be more associated with love and relationships, the fact that it would be between equals, not bound to traditions, and the need for a witness, these wishes, it's kind of like be careful what you wish for, because as you pointed out, we are seeing this more and more now, and I think that some of that might have to do with this whole idea of instant gratification in our culture, because with the internet and technology, we suddenly now can have pretty much whatever we want when we want it. And when I say us, I know that that is a privileged portion of the planet, and so I want to be very aware of that. But there is a lot of availability of all kinds of things. And so the idea that people are no longer going through arranged marriages, for example, which of course are part of all of our history in one cultural form or another, and being able to almost be indulgent enough in their life to feel like they want and deserve someone to witness them. I think there's some really interesting dynamics here that help us wade into what you were talking about the projective identification. And I wonder if some of that is related actually to our sense of entitlement or sense of expectation or sense of what it is that we deserve in life or in relationship. Can you help me sort through our needs for individuation, which are coming from a soul level, I completely believe, and also what is kind of culturally conditioned in us at this point in time in the 21st century that is telling us what we want and what we expect out of a relationship?
Well, I think there's no question that sort of more privileged people, let's say middle class and higher in terms of class, have been pushing more and more for entitlement, narcissism, wanting to have their own needs and desires met over and above sort of traditional obligations. And when I wrote The Self-Esteem Trap, it's about the kind of parenting that produces a kind of epidemic of narcissism in young people, where children are kind of over-parented and they're saved from themselves and all sorts of projections are made about how wonderful they are and how terrific they're going to be and how they should just aim for anything they want in life, et cetera, et cetera. That created a generation of young people who were afraid of leaving childhood, who have difficulty separating, have all sorts of problems with their self-esteem. And so it backfired in many ways and needs to be reexamined. So you could say there's a possibility that this style of relationship, this thing that I'm calling personal love, is an outgrowth of the same kinds of mistakes that parents made by trying to inject self-esteem into their children and by trying to protect their children from negative experiences. But I actually think that it's a little different from that. I think that at the point in human development, well, you can look at the history of marriage, and in the book I write quite a bit about the history of marriage because I'm very interested in it. Marriage became a legal institution in the Middle Ages, and before that it was a sacrament, but it wasn't a legal institution. At the point it became a legal institution, men actually were the owners of their children and their women, as well as the property and so on. And so the women took the men's names, the women lost their property, they lost their personal rights in going through marriage. Now that setup, which is very hierarchical, lasted for centuries, and of course it's still going on in much of the world. I mean, much of the world is not going through this personal love issue that I'm describing, because still marriages are arranged and also couples are not having a personal relationship in many places in Asia and so on. But I think that in the West, as we moved more and more towards a sanctity of individual rights, where people were able to gain the right of personal sovereignty, to vote, to make decisions for themselves, then those rights were distributed among all sorts of people, not just the people at the highest levels of a hierarchy. As that happened, you open the possibility that any individual, no matter their station in life, can develop and become educated and have a meaningful life. Now, once you open that door, it almost is going to guarantee that this kind of hierarchy in family life is going to be questioned. And I think in this period of time that we're in right now, we've had the issue of people who had not previously been able to get married wanting to get married. Gay and lesbian people, transgendered people, and so on. And so there's been this revolution in regard to marriage itself, that all sorts of people can get married. It's not just for reproduction. It's not just for the owning of property and so on. And so as that has happened, and as we have more and more fought for the equality of rights for all individuals, then it seems to me it's a natural outgrowth that we're going to want those kinds of rights in our relationships with our spouses, our partners, or whatever you want to call that other role that we want for companionship and friendship and then ultimately witnessing. So whereas I think that there does have to be a certain kind of privilege associated with a society to have this kind of love, I also think that there is something that is more spiritual, that is more compelling, that is more fundamental about having respect for the individual and allowing individuals to have rights that has now entered into marriage. So in my way of looking at this from a larger spiritual framework, I think that love between equals allows us to work more closely with consciousness as a relational field. Consciousness, in my view, does not come from the brain. It's not inside of the brain. It doesn't have that much to do with the brain, except you have to have some kind of brain in order to participate and be aware of it. But it is an interactional field. It's a dynamic field between beings. And for human consciousness, it's the field between human beings. And what we do to develop that, because it's developed through language, it's developed through religions, ceremonies, art, creativity, and trauma, you know, because there are certain things about trauma that allow new developments to take place as old structures break down. That field, that dynamic field, becomes extremely important to us on a personal level in regard to the people we love. We want and we feel quite directly an identification with the people that we love. We have attachment bonds with them. We want the best for them. We want the best for our relationships with them. And so it's very important to us that we succeed in bringing about a certain kind of happiness for the people that we love. Now, because of all of that, and because of this situation that we're in, I believe that all of us are going to have to learn some skills that we haven't previously learned. And those skills have something to do with mindfulness, that is, with being aware on a moment-to-moment basis of what's going on within ourselves, with being able to have something like equanimity or containment of our feelings so that we can feel them before we decide how we're going to express them. I think previously there was this tendency to either discharge them or to repress or suppress the feelings rather than just experience them. So there's a skill in being able to feel sad without being sad or feel angry without being angry. So that skill that I would call our mindfulness of feelings, and then also an ability to speak to each other in a way that cultivates truth and kindness simultaneously. And to be able to do those things in the midst of tremendous emotional activation, which one has naturally in a close relationship. I mean, you can practice a lot of mindfulness skills at retreats and get very good at practicing in an environment that is very protected. But then when you go home and you're faced with your spouse or your children or somebody's having a crisis or whatever, you know, how does it go then? And what happens to all of that mindfulness when you're very emotionally activated? So my feeling is that the kind of love that we've asked for in this period of time, it's tremendously challenging, but if we're able to develop it, we might be on a new horizon for human consciousness, that we would have the ability to deal with conflict without making an enemy. And, you know, I think that has implications for all levels of society. And in that way, it's very promising because there are possibilities. But then on another level, it's also very disconcerting and troubling because a lot of relationships, I think, these days are very much in trouble. And they're in trouble because of this difficulty with constant power struggle and an inability to negotiate conflicts within families. So a lot of times people ask me, because I go out and speak a lot to Buddhist groups particularly, and I'm a longtime Buddhist and a mindfulness teacher, and people will say, well, why is it so difficult to have world peace? And I usually say, well, how are things going in your family? You know, because there are very few families that are very harmonious.
And if they are harmonious, often there's so much underneath the surface that is not actually coming up but needs to.
Yeah, the harmony that's based on the suppression of conflict is not true harmony. it's really the pretense of harmony, or it's the appearance of harmony. But if there is harmony based on working through conflict and being able to speak truthfully and kindly about your own needs and being able also to accommodate other people's needs, that's a very skillful harmony. And I think, you know, this is just me with my little crystal ball, but I don't think we're going to bring about tremendous cultural and social changes by legislating language, by telling people what they can say or how they can say it. I don't think we're going to bring it about also by policing everybody's behaviors. You know, that just creates resentment and alienation and other kinds of difficulties. The one way that I think we could bring about this sort of greater openness to difference and to otherness, or whatever you want to call it, is by helping people develop skills in the relationships that they care most about. Because if you have your skills for dialogue, for mindfulness, for transformation of your complexes or your most difficult habit patterns, if you have those skills in your family, you can take them out into the world, because your family is a harder place to test those skills than the world at large. And so my feeling is that learning to have conflict with respect, learning to disagree with someone without making them into an enemy, learning to be a witness to somebody, even if they're very different from you at a particular moment, and activating and pushing all of your buttons, if you can do that in your family, you could do that any place. So, you know, I'm hopeful in that way about this kind of crisis in relationship in the 21st century. And so I do think there's a tremendous amount of narcissism and personal love, because the way that it comes across right now is that I'll be in this as long as it suits me. And if it doesn't suit me, I'm getting out. But I think on the other hand, people cannot just move through so much loss in their lives. I mean, they have to stop somewhere and say, hey, maybe I need to go through this rather than get out of it.
Well, what you're saying, I think, is really important, because I remember, in fact, in my own life at one point many years ago, somebody telling me, look, you have to do your own work, and you're going to be working on whatever it is that you came here basically in this life to work on, and that theme is going to be up for you regardless of who you're with. So you can be with one person, or you can be with another person, or you can be all by yourself and maybe not even in a relationship, and you're still going to have to address that theme, and you're going to have to address it over and over again no matter who you're with. So for me, that was really meaningful, because I think it comes back and speaks to what you're saying. I guess a couple of ideas. One is that of consciousness and the basic understanding of how one is in the relationship and how open or closed, et cetera. I mean, it's not always easy to know. But the other idea is just with that persistence of, you know, the honeymoon is over, to your point, and we always think there's going to be a certain happiness factor that sort of shows up because we've chosen somebody that we think is our significant other and they're going to be the one. And when the challenges start to arise and we don't feel witnessed and we start to come into some of those conflicts, that's when we start to get in trouble. And yet, if we have that commitment to working on ourselves and our own themes, then imagine in a relationship, and I'm sure you do this all the time, both people are committed to that, then the changes can actually start coming about in a sense that you end up in a dance with the other person, so that your weaknesses and shortcomings are actually shored up and you can break through because you are being witnessed, because the other person knows how important it is to work on yourself because they're working on themselves. So I think maybe I'm going in circles with that, but I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about that sense of duality. You had used the word enemy earlier, and that's a pretty strong word, but I know that some people can end up feeling like the person that they're in relationship with is an enemy. And so I wonder if you can just say something more about how that plays out.
Well, I find that in the couples that I see in therapy right now, and even couples I meet up with socially, that the word enemy is not too strong a word, because it's the feeling that I've been betrayed by somebody who knows me well. So they're not betraying me out of ignorance. They're betraying me out of something else, some sort of motivation. by betrayal here, I don't mean lying, cheating, stealing, sexual betrayal. I simply mean the betrayal of trust, where somebody says, I invested this trust in you, and you broke that trust. And it can have to do with very trivial things even. You know, I asked you to clean the garage 3 months ago. You promised me you would. And now it's 3 months and you haven't lifted a finger. That feels like a betrayal because you know how important it is to me that the garage be organized. So it's personal. So when I say enemy, I don't mean enemy from the point of view of really awful things, but from the feeling that this other person has hurt you personally, or the other person doesn't see you when you've tried so hard to be seen and known, and you've tried to use all of your words, and they're not listening to your words. So what happens in those times, in those moments, is that whatever the underlying themes are, and Jungians will talk about psychological complexes, which are these habit patterns in our emotions, in our affective life, in which we have the habit of seeing ourselves in certain ways and seeing others in certain ways. And that could be around our identity, or it can be around our dependency, or it can be around our power. You know, these are all areas where people have psychological complexes that have been organized usually by their early lives in their families originally. From a Buddhist perspective, they can even be karmic. They can be things carrying over from other lifetimes. So within these complexes, we have defenses, and we see things just in the way we see them. When you come up against somebody who has a very different view, at that moment, you have the possibility of breaking down your view. And the more you clash, you have maybe even a greater possibility, as long as you don't destroy trust or destroy your care for each other, a greater possibility to see things from another view. I think in love, whether it's love of our parents, our children, our friends, or our spouses or partners, in all of those forms of love, we're going to come up against these kinds of clashes and differences and so on. When it is a love between equals, which could be grown children and their parents, friends, or partners, at that point, nobody has power over anybody else. And so there's even a greater possibility of being able to take a step back and to see the other person and the other person's point of view and the other person's limitations, insights, strengths, and so on. And as you see those, you begin to feel who you are, especially if you have been very entangled with that other person along the lines of wanting to control them, wanting things to turn out well for them, wanting to change them, wanting to get something from them. So the way that I look at consciousness as a relational field, I think that the dynamics of human awareness grow through relationship more than they do through any other means. You know, sometimes it's a relationship with ourselves, but it's very hard for us to see ourselves. It's very hard for us to, even when we look in the mirror, you know, the image is reversed. So we really need others to help us see ourselves. And this is part of the dilemma of being human. Like, we're very unconscious. We're about 95% unconscious by the research on consciousness and unconsciousness in mental activities. So we're about 95% unconscious. We're profoundly dependent. We're like, you know, the higher apes. We really are very involved. We're social beings. And we're interactive in a very profound way. And so in order to become conscious, in order to really see what's going on, the patterns, and to understand what reality is and to be able to see ourselves and to find meaning in our lives and so on, we need each other to do that. So we have to sort through the back and forth of bumping up against each other in order to see actually what's going on for ourselves. And doing that in a close or ongoing relationship, of course, gives a lot more information than just running into a lot of strangers. So my feeling about consciousness is that it grows and develops through relationship, and that Eros, which is the desire to connect, is the kind of origin of consciousness. And also, Eros is up against, then, a lot of more destructive urges in human beings, which have to do mostly with self-protection and with the feelings of threat. So I don't know exactly where you would like to go with this, but from the point of view of the kinds of larger social issues that we're dealing with in this period of time, trying to work with the problems of the kind of inequality that undergirds American society, the ways in which, say, for example, slavery contributed to the wealth of the nation and then created this very oppressive system that we call racism, and the way we want to handle that now, and as we come to try to understand the ways that it's affected people and the whole sort of mythology of skin color and so on, I think we need some sort of methodology that allows people to deal with these differences without destroying each other's dignity and identity. And that's going to be a step-by-step process. Like I said, I don't think it's going to be legislated. I think people have to discover it and that it has to be developed from skills. So I have really some optimism about working with couple relationships as a way of learning how to deal with conflict and the desire to make the other person wrong. What I didn't mention is that often what leads us to the greatest painful blaming and shaming is when our ideals are betrayed. And so having ideals that are human-sized, that actually relate to what it's like to be human, instead of relating somehow to how we imagine the world should be or what we think people should be like, I think does lead us to a better sort of chance of being compassionate with each other. I wanted to bring this in at some point, so I'm going to bring in, I'm a great fan of the singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen, and I've studied his songs and saw him perform and just recently went twice to the big retrospective celebration of his work in Montreal. And what he says in his song Hallelujah, which is about love, is that love is not some kind of victory march. He says, I've seen your flag on the marble arch. Love is not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. And in some of the interviews, he says, look, love is the reason why we're here. It's the way we got in here. We were created through love. And it's the way we disappear with each other. Our boundaries go down when we experience love. But love is an inherently impossible thing to do. And so it's already broken before you go into it. And he says, if you know that, you actually can go in with more compassion for yourself and others than if you go in with these ideals, like you're going to be a hero or you're going to march through life with the victories of love. That's actually going to make you suffer more. He says, instead, if you know that your heart is like a shish kebab, you know, it's burning, it's going to be roasted, that you actually will do better than if you think that you're going to work everything out. And I think that's a very, very big lesson about love. If you know that it's inherently broken, then you know that it's not the problem of your family, of your partner, or of you. It's the nature of love itself. It's very, very difficult for human beings. And it's not the same thing as an attachment bond. It's not the same thing as secure attachment. And it's certainly not the same thing as romance. So to find out what love is really kind of a lifetime study, but also it's a lifetime practice. It's not easy.
Well, what wonderful insights on navigating the emotional landscape of relationships, Polly, and the profound opportunity that applying ourselves consciously can really be in the individuation process. And of course, I'm really grateful for you bringing in the work of Leonard Cohen and the words of that song, so profoundly insightful as well. I've been speaking with Polly Young Eisendrath, who is a Jungian psychoanalyst, psychologist, and author. And of course, her latest book, the upcoming Love Between Equals, Relationship as a Spiritual Path, has been the topic of our conversation today. And you can find out more about Polly on her website, which is jung-eisendrath.com, and that's spelled jung-eisendrath.com. And of course, Polly is speaking, as we mentioned, at the upcoming Trauma and Transcendence Conference, which is taking place at Pacifica in Santa Barbara, California, June 22nd through the 24th. That's going to be a very dynamic two-day symposium with a lot of well-known and recognized names and experts in the field of trauma and transcendence. The title of your presentation there, Polly, The Gates of Mercy, Portals of Transcendence, According to Jung and Buddhism. And to find out more about that conference, you can go to pacifica.edu and click on events and then click on the retreat. You'll find the information there. Thanks so much for your time today, Polly.
You've been listening to Discussions in Depth Psychology, powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute with host Bonnie Bright.
Learn more at pacificapost.com or at pacifica.edu.